This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 232 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. Hello, Max. How are we?
David, very good. I'm excited about the stories we have this episode. It's kind of an interesting cross-section of different aspects of unmanned aircraft. I kind of like the lineup this week.
Sometimes we have a short news week, but the news stories are more interesting. So, and I know that we had a short news week earlier in the week. We're recording this a day early, so I have the potential of going flying for drones on Friday if I can cook up with our show compadre Parker from Propeller Heads Videography in upstate New York. I hope to have lunch with him on Friday. So maybe I'll do some drone flying this weekend, Max.
Nice.
So tonight's topics: drones and decoys, and I don't think the decoys are what you're going to expect. Facial recognition for direction. Bye-bye to the drone that launched a podcast. I'm a bit sad about this one. And another Your Grounded story and some listener mail. So I guess, Max, we should get started. Our first story is from Atlas Obscura. Why drones are counting thousands of decoy ducks? How do you prove your data is correct when you're doing things like photographing large flocks of birds or animals? Is your data really being properly counted? And so what happened with this story, Max?
Well, here we have researchers at the University of Adelaide's Environment Institute and School of Biological Sciences, and they wanted to find out just how accurate are these counts when they're performed by drones, or at least when drones are used in the process. So what they did is they set up some decoy terns in 10 colonies along a shoreline. Now, these are a lot of decoys. These are a lot of birds. Each colony had between 463 and 1,017 decoys. So multiply that by 10. I wonder where they got all those decoys from.
Max, they probably didn't do it all on one day.
Maybe one colony at a time. That would make sense. Okay, sometimes I just miss the obvious.
Max is an engineer. Can you tell that I grew up with an engineer? They overthink things.
Yeah, that's true. So they set up this experiment, and they compared counts conducted two ways. One is the old way, where they used some experienced ecologists and had them count the birds by foot, by visual observation, by binoculars. And then they had some drones take photos of the decoys, and those were given to citizen scientists, is what they called them. And then they compared the counts. Of course, they knew what the actual count was. And David, what did they find?
The drone counts were better than the estimates done by the experts. This is always funny because all I could think of was, this is a great way to prove that drones are really good at accurate counting. But then I thought about all of the things like, did you know, Max, the Eagles won the Super Bowl?
I thought we were done with that.
and did you know that Philadelphia had a parade? And every time they have an event in Philadelphia on the parkway, there's always some guy that's estimating how many people were actually on the parkway for X event, be it one of our summer things. So maybe we need to have a drone fly along so they can get more accurate representation of how many people were actually at the Eagles Super Bowl parade. But that goes for everything. So it really was kind of a neat way to prove that the data you're getting is accurate, relevant, and useful, which you always want for something like this.
Yeah, I always wondered how they did those crowd counts, and I guess the same thing here with these bird counts. But there are lots of wildlife measurements or counts that are being conducted around the globe. The accuracy of the counts, as you say, David, is really important to the outcome, the decisions that are made. And so if drones can assist in that, improving the accuracy of the data, hey, that's a good thing.
So I did come up with one thing that I didn't see answered in the article, and I'd love to find out the answer. These were decoys. How effective are decoys at moving when they hear a loud quadcopter come overhead, unlike the real thing?
Yeah, they don't move much.
They don't move. The decoys don't move much. So I'm interested to wonder what if there's some sort of factor that you take into play when you fly a quadcopter over a flock of geese or ducks, and they scatter. Because one of our very, very first stories on this show was about a guy in Ontario scaring geese, Canada geese, off the beach with a quadcopter because the noise drove them off the beach. So interesting. This is one of those things I'm like, yeah, okay, I get the whole, it's a really useful way to count, but these weren't moving targets.
Yeah, sometimes the measurement technique can affect the measurement.
But you could go to our next story if you're saying the tool, the measurement equals the measurement. Well, what about using your eyes and your face and your hands to fly drones? In this case, this is from one of our favorite websites, thedrive.com. Samsung just patented display drones controlled by your eyes, face, and hand gestures. This is one of those sci-fi things that if you told us 4 years ago when we started this show that we'd be talking about, I would be saying, yeah, right. But this is pretty cool technology.
Yeah, it is. I'm just wondering how it could be used. But what we have here is the United States Patent and Trademark Office has given this patent to Samsung. It's for a flying display device, and it's described as a quadcopter. It's got a camera, a big display, a GPS, and a positioning system that uses Wi-Fi as well as voice recognition. And I guess the way you think about this is it's a flying screen, and it reacts to you, to your movements, your expression, all of these things, and then displays some kind of information on the screen. So I don't know, David, if the idea is that these are, you know, little sales devices or marketing devices or something of that sort where, you know, if you've got a business or a concession stand or something, you use it to draw customers in. I don't know. Is that the application that Samsung has in mind? I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either. I just thought it was in, I forget what the sci-fi is with Tom Cruise, the Minority Report.
Hmm.
In Minority Report, it's the 21st century, like, and one of the creepiest things that they do as he's walking through the mall, and we've started to get to this point, is as he's walking through the mall, the billboards personally change directly to him and to his personal taste because of his retina scan.
Hmm.
You know, and I always thought that that was a neat special effect, but it was also kind of creepy. I mean, if you've been on Facebook lately, all of it, if you go shopping on some website, suddenly on Facebook, on the left-hand side or right-hand side, is that store that you were shopping at. This would be interesting that you'd have a drone that would recognize you and post a billboard for you, or maybe the giant screen is just so you hold it in front of your face so you can fly the drone and operate it. That screen interprets what the drone's going to do. So it's kind of like the 3D binoculars that you wear for virtual reality. Maybe this is a next step virtual reality, and Samsung's pretty good about VR.
That's true.
My understanding and the way I looked at this was it was a virtual reality drone. By using the screen, you could fly the drone using your face and your eyeballs and your hands as recognition, like you would in virtual reality.
Of course. Yeah, my standard comment when I was going to say,
are you going to use the patented Max Flight corollary about patents?
Yeah, I have to, which is simply that just because someone is awarded a patent, it doesn't mean that it will ever actually happen. Patents these days are used as corporate assets in a way. And even if you never build this, well, somebody else might want to, in which case, if you have the patent, then you have an asset that has some value. So you see this a lot where companies will just patent every idea they can possibly think of in order to just amass a group of patents. And I'm not sure what Samsung's history in that regard is, if they're one of those kinds of companies. But again, the point is that just because they have a patent doesn't mean it will actually ever get built.
And I should correct myself. It should be Max Flight's copyrighted rule about patents. Okay. Now, if you've been listening to this show from day one, you know that this is kind of heartbreaking to me, because the next story actually has a direct effect on Max and I. When we, years ago, started this show, one of the things that my biggest pet peeve was anytime someone talked about a drone, whether it be a little quadcopter or anything, there was a picture of a RQ or an MQ Predator in the newspaper. And most likely, it was a generic Air Force shot where it was showing firing a Hellfire. Well, the Air Force has announced something, Max. We've outlived the MQ Predators. They are retiring them in March, only a couple of weeks from as we record this. And this was from the Air Force Times. So what do you think, Max? The aircraft that started this show is being retired by the Air Force, is no longer an asset that they want.
Well, my question, David, is why is that? Why are they retiring these Predators? And what are they going to use instead?
They've moved on to the MQ-9, which is the Reaper, which is the Predator B in civilian terms. It's a bigger, faster, heavier payload, longer endurance aircraft. The Predators are no longer a very sophisticated aircraft, considering they were built years ago. And originally, if you keep this in mind, Predators weren't even armed. They were RQs. And it wasn't until the Iraq War where they decided to hang a Hellfire on them. So they were the start of armed, military armed aircraft or armed UAVs. But they are old, and the technology has moved well beyond that, and the Reaper is a better aircraft. But that's not to be said that there's a lot of Predator drones that the Air Force has that they're going to have to get rid of. So what do they do with them? Well, it may be like SR-71s and F-16s, and suddenly there's going to be a lot of museums with Predators in them, besides the United States Air Force Museum and the Smithsonian Institution. I might add, both of those have Predators. And give them to the Navy, or give them to the Coast Guard, or give them to, how about this? I'm going to legacy into last week's episode. Maybe the Department of Interior wants two or three of them, as we talked about last week.
Yeah. Huh.
So I'm really kind of sad, but it just shows you how diverse this subject has been, Max. And here's to us for outliving the Predator. Let's hope we can outlive the DJI Phantom.
Yeah, I wouldn't count on that. that would be kind of amazing. But yeah, interesting. I think the article points out that one place where these predators won't end up in private hands. We can't look forward to our very own predator, David, with the UAV Digest logo across the side and circling around events.
Well, Max, we got a press release. Since I took the last story, you want to take this one?
Sure. This came from Tsuyoshi, who's the PR manager at a company called V-Cube Robotics. They're Tokyo-based. They're a company. They focus on drone and UAV technologies. And we have a link from SUAS News where this press release is reproduced. It's titled, V-Cube Robotics Begins Offering Solar Check, a Solar Power Plant Inspection Package Service. Well, V-Cube Robotics is offering this solar check. It's a package for just exactly what it sounds like, inspection of solar power plants using drones. And the idea is, you've got these arrays of solar panels out there, and you have to inspect them from time to time. And the process to do that manually is very time consuming. And the idea here is that you'd use these drones to fly autonomously over the solar panels following a predetermined flight path. And they would inspect the panels using infrared cameras. These images get uploaded to the cloud and analyzed. And then discrepancies, things like hot spots or other problems, are identified and communicated to the operators of the solar power plant. So it's obviously, David, it's a very specialized use for drones, but the payoff here seems to be pretty significant.
Solar farms, I mean, we have a couple of them in the area. It's a growing population where people put out large solar, clean energy. We've been talking about it for years up until January of last year. And it's a tedious process where anytime you've got large areas to inspect, a UAV would be much easier to use than walking the line. I'm interested to know, though, how do they protect the drone flying over these solar fields? They're notorious for getting hot. A couple of the solar fields in California, birds have come across and been burned because of the solar. So I'm curious how they protect the UAV. It makes sense that they're using infrared because something broke is not going to show as hot as the other solar panels. But I was just curious how you protect the UAV in that environment. Hmm. But yeah, I know I'm on a fire this week, Max. I'm thinking out of the box about everything.
Yeah, I didn't know they got that hot enough to affect birds. But they give some idea of just how much time can be saved with this system. And they mentioned that a manual inspection of a 2-megawatt solar power plant might typically take 4 days. And with this solar check system, it can be done in 15 minutes. They say it's more accurate than the manual check. And with something that's so easy and fast, you can conduct inspections more often, right? If it takes 4 days to do it manually, how often are you going to do that? But if you can do the whole thing in 15 minutes, hey, it's much easier. You can conduct more frequent inspections. So,
and you can make changes, which reduces your costs because you're not sitting there for 4 days waiting for someone to discover a panel that's out.
Yeah.
So, I mean, very interesting subject matter. Again, if anybody knows how do you protect quadcopters or aircraft from hot solar areas, let me know. Okay, one of these ones, your grounded files. Helicopter crash on Daniel Island may have been caused by a drone. This is from the postandcourier.com. And this is a Robinson R-22 on a training flight in South Carolina. And evidently, there was a UFU, unidentified flying UAV, in the area. But it was identified, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was identified as being a DJI Phantom. At least that's what the pilot and the student are saying. Apparently, the student was practicing a maneuver. The student was at the controls, and then they saw a white DJI Phantom quadcopter, they said, was headed into their airspace. So the instructor took over control of the helicopter and tried to avoid the drone, but reportedly the tail hit some brush or a small tree or something like that. They lost control of the helicopter, and this Robinson R-22 ended up on its side.
For every article on the internet, there are comments. And the comments for this article are leaning more towards really wasn't the drone's fault, it was pilot error. First one was, the drone, if there was one, didn't cause the crash. That was 100% pilot error. For one, not recognizing the drone itself could not harm the aircraft. And two, for failing miserably at evasive maneuvers. Okay. You know, if you're an instructor pilot and a student pilot and the student pilot's under controls and you need to do evasive action, having been a student pilot, there's a few seconds of disorientation for both the instructor and the student pilot. So I'm not sure about that one. How about the next one, Max?
Well, another commenter pointed out that the tail rudder hit a brush or a small tree. And to this commenter, that seemed like they must have been awfully low for a trainee pilot to be practicing a maneuver like that. It just sort of struck this commenter as being a little bit odd. Yeah, like you say, David, there's always...
There's more to the story.
Yeah, there's more to the story, maybe. And you know, the comments usually kind of get out of control. But it just struck me that the comments seem to be almost consistently...
Pro-drone?
Pro-drone, yeah. Saying that something seems fishy here or, you know, something like that. So the FAA is investigating. I think that it may be difficult to determine just exactly what happened here. I don't know if they've got the Phantom or if it just scooted away and never to be found again.
Our next story is from UASVision.com. Airline groups call on U.S. Congress to regulate drones. Last week, we talked about Europe being very favorable to drones. And here the U.S. airlines, in their usual cantankerous ways, are kind of pushing a negative version of drone regulation. What do you think, Max?
Yeah, this came from three groups who sent a letter to Congress. And those were the Airline Pilots Association, ALPA, Airlines for America, A4A, and NATCA, the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. And they're looking at the incidents we see with drones approaching manned aircraft, flying around airports, all of these things. So these three groups, they want to see the 2012 FAA Modernization and Reform Act changed. That act restricts the FAA from applying any rules or regulations to UASs flown for recreational use or as a hobby. They want all UAVs to be subject to FAA regulations, regardless of whether they're used for, any purpose, whether they're used for commercial purpose, whether they're used for recreational or hobby use. These groups want to see the law changed so that the FAA can regulate hobby use of UAVs.
Okay. I'm going to forgive NACTA this year, because if you are a National Air Traffic Controllers Association person and you have their yearly calendar, I'm in March. That's my photograph. Yeah. But the other two, I'm going to nail. They need to understand that maybe they should stop worrying about the FAA monitoring drones and start worrying about the FAA getting funded so they can monitor drones. This always seems to be a bit of the putting the cart before the horse. I know that the 2012 regulation is to fund, it gives the authority because it's funding the FAA, but right now there's not any indication that the FAA is going to be funded or minimum funding. So I don't know how they're going to be chasing all these drones when they're going to have short staffs and other things like that. So there's my two cents. And after March, I'll be anti-NACTA again. So
I just think it's kind of unrealistic to think that all the regulations that are applied to commercial use of drones or will be in the future should also apply to hobby use. You're not going to put ADS-B on DJI Phantoms. You're not going to impose the same requirements on home-built drones built for racing. So I think this is just, you know, I tried to think about why would these groups take this stand? And the thing that came to my mind is maybe they're doing this just as a way to protect themselves so that they can say, hey, we saw an issue. It's dangerous that drones are being flown near commercial airliners and around airports and all that. But we tried. We asked Congress to include those UAVs, those drones, in the regulations that are created by the FAA. So we've done our part. We did as much as we could. That's the only logic that I could come up with that makes any sense to me. So if any of you listening have some other viewpoints on why this might be a good thing to do to change the FAA Modernization and Reform Act of 2012, write to us. Let us know. I'd be glad to hear some different viewpoints on that.
Okay. We got a video of the week. This came from a couple of people. And this was, our first story was from Fortune.com. And our friend of the show and our co-host on our other show, Max Trescott, lives in the area. And evidently someone was trying to film the brand new Apple building, Apple Park, over the weekend, and got their drone caught on the roof. Oops.
Oops, big oops. I guess the drone operator doesn't really know why the drone experienced loss of control. It was a Phantom 4 Pro. And from the footage, that you can just see the thing. It just loses control and drops down. The other guy, the different drone pilot who has been overflying Apple Park and providing all these great videos of the construction, he was actually the one that went out and searched over Apple Park and found this drone. We talked about solar panels before. Well, it was kind of nestled in and amongst the solar panels on the roof. The operator of the drone notified Apple about this crash, but I'm not sure he's ever going to see that drone again.
Nah, I'm not even sure that Apple is going to spend the money to go up there to get it down. That's a lot of money to send somebody up there unless there's some easy way to do it and go and get it. So it may be up there for a while, or it may be gone by now, but I'm sure there's a drone video at this point that will show that. And, you know, the drone malfunctioning, let's start a conspiracy theory. That Apple.
Yeah. I thought of this too.
Has an anti-drone system. But my problem with the Apple having an anti-drone system was, then how come the guy could videotape the downed drone and do the search and rescue? Because if the anti-drone system worked, that wouldn't have worked either. So, you know, we may need to send up a quadcopter with a grappling hook to rescue the drone from the captivity of Apple. And this is coming from somebody who's Apple everything in his household. Well, our next one is from the drone professor, Tim Trott. I'm going to let my co-host help me with this one because I wasn't really understanding. Sorry, Tim.
Yeah, this is from the droneprofessor.com post there, a message from APSA regarding the new CAPS and COA process. APSA is the Airborne Public Service Association. And what we see here, and you'll want to check the post on Tim's website, but just briefly, the FAA has moved the Certificate of Authorization or waiver, the COA application and reporting site, that's CAPS, to a new domain and URL. It's now at CAPS caps.faa.gov. But the new site, well, it requires some new things. You have to set up a new account, and you have to enter in a lot of really personal information, address, your cell number, your social security number. And this is kind of a problem, particularly for law enforcement or other agencies that really don't want to publicly produce this kind of information. The folks involved in this are aware. They've been notified of this kind of issue. There are some workarounds that have been proposed, but they're not all that great. But you can learn more about that, at the post that Tim has at thedroneprofessor.com, and we'll have a link to that one in the show notes. And thanks, Tim, for passing that along.
So to dovetail off of our conversation earlier about the Apple building, or the Apple spaceship, Cal sent us a question, and I believe we're waiting for a little feedback, and we'll probably have it next week from our resident San Jose pilot, Max Trescott. But if I measure the distance from the campus to the nearest airport, SJC, it's actually right at the 5-mile line, or a little in or out, depending upon where you measure from. Could these drone pilots be at risk of violating FAA directives for flying this close? Or is 5 miles more a fuzzy limit? This also brings up a question of geofencing. Is the 5-mile limit geofenced somehow? And where does that 5-mile limit even begin, i.e. at the edge of the airport or the center? I know that we talked about this before, and I believe it's 5 miles from the edge of the airport. No, it's not, is it? No, it's 5 miles from the center.
I think it's 5 miles from the center.
From the geographic center of the airport, which means it's not really 5 miles.
Right. And the other part of that is you could have a huge airport and a little airport, and you have to be farther away from the edge of the little airport than you do of the, you know, of the big international airport. But if you think about it, the airport boundary is usually an irregular shape. If it's 5 miles from that irregular shape, that means you've got this really odd shaped area. And, you know, how are you going to specify the outline of that area in an app, or, you know, in a program that's used to identify if you're within 5 miles, or if for a geofencing application, let's say. It's just too complicated. So to me, it makes a lot more sense to say, okay, we're going to pick the geographic center of the airport because you know the latitude and longitude of that, and then you can easily identify what's 5 miles away from that or not. So I'm pretty sure it's the center. If I'm wrong,
yeah, I am too. I am too. Now that we've talked about it in the past, I don't know if the FAA will actually get involved. However, Apple could probably bring charges against this person for vandalism or damage of property.
Trespassing.
From an insurance standpoint, that drone might have damaged one of those solar panels as it bounced off. So that person could be responsible for that solar panel, which could be a very heavy price tag if Apple decides to choose to sue them. So whether it's legal, remember, Cass, that the FAA doesn't really have an enforcement. They can suggest to bring charges, et cetera, but they really don't have an enforcement arm. But it'll be interesting to see what further outcomes occur because of this.
Yeah, and also I would add, you know, if you're flying a drone, don't fly it over something where it would cause a problem if the drone goes down, because these are just machines. They're hardware and software, and they're not perfect, and something can happen, something can go wrong. And if you're flying over something where if it did go down, it would cause a problem, injury to people, damage to personal property, then by overflying that, you are putting yourself at some degree of risk. So you need to think about that.
So don't do it.
Don't do it. All right. Well, we need to wrap this one up. We want to thank you all for listening to episode 232 of the UAV Digest. You can find show notes at theuavdigest.com/232.
And of course, we want you to join our Slack listener team. And you can do that by sending us an email to feedback@theUAVDigest.com. You can also use that email address to send us your videos and your questions. Remember, Max wants to know why ALPA and A4A and NACTA all want the government to monitor even more drones. So send us your opinions on that. We'd love to hear that. In other news, we might have some guests lined up, so that will be a good thing. And on social media, you can find us on Twitter at UAV Digest, on Facebook at UAV Digest, and leave us some feedback on your podcatcher of choice, Google Play or iTunes or Stitcher. And of course, you can purchase some swag at our Cafe Press store. So with that, I'm going to say, hopefully this is David in Fort Washington, who might get to fly a drone this weekend.
And Max in Hartford.
Thank you for listening.